then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, O O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's December the 2nd, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Interesting Edgar Steele update this week. Some major holes are starting to appear in the prosecution's case, such as it was. I'd like to thank Mr. James Buchanan for putting this out on the internet, and this comes from his report. Now, according to the informant Larry Fairfax, Edgar Steele was going to have Fairfax murder Cindy Steele, and then Edgar was going to pay Fairfax with money from an insurance policy on Cindy's life. In a recent interview that Cindy Steele gave to Jimmy Kelso of the White News Now site, Cindy has revealed that the Steeles had canceled their insurance policies. Now, this pretty much demolishes the government case against Edgar Steele. If anyone other than Edgar Steele was being accused, he would have been released from prison by now. Now, just for those of you who are not familiar with this case, a little over a year ago, Edgar Steele suffered a ruptured heart aorta. He was rushed to the hospital and escaped death by the narrowest of margins. After weeks in the hospital, Steele was able to return home in a very greatly weakened condition. Now, Cindy Steele hired a handyman, Larry Fairfax, to fix some pipes that had been damaged by freezing water. Now, the Steeles then retained Fairfax to do work around their ranch while Edgar Steele was convalescing. Now, unknown to the Steeles, Larry Fairfax had previously worked as an informant for the FBI, so he does have a history of this kind of thing. I think his appearance at the Steele home was not a coincidence. Over the next 6 months, Larry Fairfax spied on the Steeles as a government informant. Now, years earlier, Edgar Steele defended the Aryan Nations from a civil lawsuit that ultimately took away the AN compound from its owner, Richard Butler. Now, since that trial, Steele has defended a number of pro-white activists, often at no charge. Edgar Steele has also written a series of articles on his conspiracypenpal.com website that exposes various government conspiracies and criticizes the state of Israel and its undue influence on our government. Clearly, Edgar Steele was not popular with the Zionists or the many pro-Zionist congressmen in our federal government. Now, in an earlier case in Idaho, the federal government sent an informant to spy on a man named Randy Weaver. After a year of spying, the federal informant eventually talked Randy Weaver into cutting off a shotgun barrel a quarter inch too short. After entrapping Mr. Weaver for a technical firearms violation, the feds then tried to pressure him to become a government informant against the Aryan Nations. The federal government reportedly spent $1 million and a year of effort in trying to turn Randy Weaver into a government informant. Weaver refused to go along with the government, and the feds responded by executing a raid and siege of Randy Weaver's home in Ruby Ridge, Idaho, in which federal agents murdered Randy Weaver's son and wife. If the federal government was willing to go to that kind of extreme measure against someone whom they wanted to turn against the Aryan Nations, how would the federal government feel about a lawyer who actually defended the Aryan Nations? The federal government was willing to break the law and even murder people in the past over the AN. Now, this means that the federal government is capable of anything based on their past behavior. The government's informant, Larry Fairfax, was employed as a handyman at Steele's ranch for 6 months. Apparently, Fairfax was unable to discover any illegal behavior by Edgar Steele during this time. In April of 2010, Larry Fairfax declared bankruptcy as his main business failed with $600,000 in debt. Fairfax was behind on his mortgage payments and in danger of having his home foreclosed. It was at this time that Fairfax is believed to have stolen $45,000 in silver from secret hiding places on the Steele estate, some of which Fairfax had built as a handyman. To cover up the theft of the $45,000, Larry Fairfax hatched a plan to murder Edgar and Cindy Steele with a massive car bomb. And when the bomb failed to go off, Fairfax fell back on a second plan to claim that Edgar Steele was plotting to murder his wife. Someone, presumably the FBI, apparently helped Fairfax fabricate fake tapes that used a simulation of Edgar Steele's voice. Cindy Steele listened to these alleged tapes of her husband, which were played to her by the feds, and noted that whenever the conversation turned from whatever chores Fairfax was supposed to do to the alleged murder plot, the inflection in Edgar's voice would disappear and the background noise would change, strongly suggesting that the tapes were fabricated. In a series of interviews with Jamie Kelso of the White News Now website, Cindy Steele revealed that the feds tried to bully her into confessing that she was cheating on her husband. Sounds like they're looking for a motive there. They claimed to have pictures of her with another man, which they didn't. When Cindy insisted that there was absolutely no truth to that, the FBI then tried to claim that a Ukrainian client of Edgar Steele was an illicit girlfriend of his, even though Edgar was still recovering and required additional surgery in the spring of 2010. Now, it was glaringly obvious that there was no reason for Edgar Steele to kill his wife, and the feds are trying to fish around to find a reason that would make a murder plot more believable. Cindy also revealed that they caught Larry Fairfax snooping around underneath their house one day, and after that they kept a very close eye on him. In May of 2010, Larry Fairfax borrowed the Steele's pickup truck and swapped the relatively new tires off it for his own truck. So you're dealing with basic dishonesty here from the get-go. Edgar Steele was arrested on June the 11th for plotting to murder his wife. Now, the bomb on Cindy Steele's car, however, was not found until June the 15th, when Cindy took her vehicle into a quick lube for an oil change. Larry Fairfax was arrested on June the 15th for possession of an explosive device. When Fairfax was questioned and admitted to putting that bomb on Cindy's car, a judge at his preliminary hearing asked why he hadn't filled the pipe bomb up with sand instead of gunpowder if he was supposed to be doing this at the behest of the FBI. Apparently, Mr. Fairfax had no answer. This, of course, assumes that Fairfax was acting as a police informant and not trying to murder Cindy Steele in order to cover up his theft of a large quantity of silver, and also to give the FBI an actual murder to work with so they could really put Edgar Steele away. According to the government, Steele was going to pay Fairfax for the murder of his wife with money from an insurance policy. The policy reportedly covered accidental death, but no one has ever explained how an enormous pipe bomb exploding could possibly be considered an accidental death. Now, an attorney such as Edgar Steele would know that a homicide does not count as an accidental death for insurance purposes. Even more important is the fact that the Steeles had canceled their insurance policies. Apparently, Larry Fairfax was ignorant of this critically important piece of information. Clearly, it's time for the government to release Edgar Steele from prison and to charge Larry Fairfax with grand theft of $45,000 in silver and the attempted murder of both Edgar and Cindy Steele. Well, Mr. Buchanan, lots of luck with that. Cindy Steele is still doing her speaking tour all around the country and all around the Internet, as she desperately tries to raise money to buy her husband the serious defense that the federal government is apparently determined he won't have, hence the freezing of all the Steele family assets. I gather Cindy herself has now been placed on more or less an allowance by the court, because they're afraid if they release all the family financial assets and bank accounts, Cindy will use the money to hire Edgar a proper attorney. Ed himself is still just sitting there in a Spokane County jail waiting for March the 7th, while the feds continue to do whatever it is they're doing in order to try and break him, and I think we can be pretty sure that's going on. I don't think there has ever been a serious bail request made since this whole madhouse started back in June. Not that Ed could afford bail anyway with all his assets frozen. Oh, while I'm thinking about it, you folks might want to go to the Edgar Steele website at www.conspiracypenpal.com and download as many of Edgar's articles and podcasts as you can. There's no telling how long this site's going to remain up, and we don't want Ed's internet work to be lost to the rest of us. That's www.conspiracypenpal.com. You know, I remember this one case many years ago from back in the day, a fairly well-known case at the time in Ohio, when one of our comrades was arrested and charged with something that was truly preposterous. but he had no money for bail and no money to hire his own attorney. So in our cash register-based justice system, he was forced to take a court-appointed lawyer whose sole function appeared to be to persuade our man to take a plea bargain. Kind of like that scene out of A Few Good Men where Demi Moore tells military lawyer character Tom Cruise, "You've had 49 cases and you've plea bargained all of them." And Tom Cruise replies, "Yeah, one more plea bargain and I get a set of steak knives." Anyway, this court-appointed attorney in the Ohio case would visit his white client in jail maybe once a month, and when he did, he absolutely refused even to discuss a not guilty plea. All he'd talk about with our friend was plea bargains and the various angles that could be worked with a plea bargain. This comrade ranted and raved and swore that he'd been set up, that he would not plead guilty to anything under any circumstances, but it was no go. The lawyer simply ignored him. The prisoner wrote to the judge in his case trying to fire his court-appointed lawyer, but the judge was in on the fix from the beginning, having appointed this asshole to defend him in the first place, and simply ignored his letters and never responded. And the prisoner never got into court to fire the lawyer there in public, because the lawyer wouldn't file a habeas corpus motion and let him come into court. Finally, after about a year and a half of this, the court-appointed attorney told our man, "Look, young man, let me explain the facts of life to you here. Now, you've been sitting here in this county jail for almost 18 months now. If you'd taken a plea bargain like I told you a year ago, you might have already had this over and done with and been out now. But what you have to understand is that the FBI does not frame people, and the FBI does not make mistakes. Never. You have to understand that there is only one way you're going to be allowed out of here. And that is that you're going to stand up in that courtroom and you are going to plead guilty to something. Doesn't matter to what. Once you agree, I'll get you the best deal I can, but you're going to stand up in court and you are going to admit that something happened. Even if it's only a no contest plea, wherein you technically don't admit guilt, but everybody knows it's really a guilty plea, that's fine. But you're going to let the FBI and the U.S. attorney off the hook. You are going to admit that something happened. Or else you're simply not coming to trial. And eventually we'll just lose your paperwork, you'll disappear into the system, and although I suppose eventually someone will find your papers, you'll end up doing many years in the county jail here when you could have been out and home already if you'd just done what you were told." Okay, admittedly that's the defendant's version of the conversation, but I can very well believe that's the way it went down. I've simply seen too much of the foul way in which our lords and masters operate to doubt him. What happened was that they finally wore him down. I mean, what was he going to do? He was a so-called white supremacist in a jail full of niggers and Mexicans, and he literally did not have one friend in the world who would help him in a judicial system wherein the very idea of justice has become a sick and bitter joke. It's hard for those who've never gone through this to understand just how terribly alone a racially aware or politically incorrect white person, male or female, is when they find themselves caught up in the legal mincing and mangling machine. Short of maybe terminal cancer, I think it's about as completely alone as it's possible to become in this society. In that Ohio case, they made it clear that this defendant was never going to have any chance to move his life forward until he confessed in public to a crime that he did not commit, and which, in fact, no one committed. So he broke and he pleaded guilty. And they gave him 10 years in prison in order to punish him for not doing as he was told and pleading guilty to begin with. There's another moral to the story. You can never, ever trust anything that anyone connected to law enforcement or the judicial system says. Any plea bargain that you think you may have is not legally enforceable. It's between you and the district attorney in that the district attorney says he or she will ask for such and such a sentence. The judge is not obligated to agree or to follow suit. The judge can simply throw the plea bargain out the window, and that happens more often than you may think. Never, ever trust anything that anyone connected to the law enforcement or the judicial system in this country says. They are liars. They are there for one purpose and one purpose only, to do you harm and build their own careers thereby on the basis of your suffering and your innocence. Never, ever trust anything that these people say. Now, that's a true story. This is what the people who rule our lives are like. This is what they do. Now, here's an email from Brian in Las Vegas. "Dear HAC, just dropping by to ask if maybe you can address this subject. Fox News and conservatives are using the Somali invaders' plot to kill whites in Portland as an excuse to get more cooperation with the Federal Joint Terrorism Task Force. According to the media reports, it was the Joint Terrorism Task Force who actually trained the Muslim nigger, told him where to go, bought him the explosives, etc., etc. Apparently, Portland is one of the cities that, by law, does not cooperate with the Joint Terrorism Task Force because of the liberal or leftist blah, 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 blah. Now, this is a great example of the useless left versus right argument in action. Well, I wasn't going to mention that dumbass Somali Muslim kid who was arrested last week for allegedly conspiring with himself to plant a truck bomb in a Christmas tree lighting in Portland. Because if I do, all the goat dancers who hide behind pseudonyms on the internet will begin to shriek and gibber that Harold is pro-Muslim, Harold is a sand nigger and raghead lover, Harold is working for Osama bin Laden, yada yada yada, ishka bibble. The news media pretty much admits that this eraserhead was not a trained ninja from Al-Qaeda or any nonsense like that. He was just some lone, crazy teenage nigger who didn't belong in Oregon of all places, and who should never have been brought to this country in the first place. And the FBI held his hand and walked him through the whole so-called plot, including providing the truck and the so-called explosives, which were dummies. But are the movement's internuts capable of wrapping their mind around this? Are they capable of internalizing that what can be done by the government to a dark-skinned Muslim can also be done to a Baptist good old boy with a baseball cap on his head and a support our troops bumper sticker and a rifle rack on his pickup truck? Is that too complex for the goat dancing fools who claim to speak for us on the internet to internalize into all that pork fat between their ears? Probably so. Okay, I won't mention that then. Now, while we're on the subject of internuts, I got an email from Tracy in Sacramento, California, saying, Dear HAC, I was following a discussion on blah, 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 and they claim that you are nothing but one guy with a computer just sitting there talking to yourself, and there is no Northwest Front. I like your novels, and I'm willing to support you no matter what, but is this true? I'd just like to know what point we're starting from. Okay, Tracy, as it happens, we have no way of knowing whether the people you refer to are legitimate members of the movement or not, because they hide behind false names. Always remember the first rule of the internet. You never know who you are talking to, and you never know what their true agenda is and why they are really saying whatever it is they're saying. But that doesn't mean that the question itself isn't legitimate. That's an accusation that's leveled against me and the NF quite often, and I'm sure a lot of people wonder about it from time to time, so I'm going to level with all of you. The quick 25 words or less answer is no, I am not all alone up here, not by any means. For one thing, Radio Free Northwest is now up to about 4,000 listeners per week. We seem to be recovering quite nicely from that slump we went into during October for whatever reason, so at least I have an audience if nothing else. Certainly not an audience as big as Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck, but I'm not just some guy sitting in a trailer talking about his cows and his bees and Jesus and his $325,000 girlfriend with only 15 members on his forum. Nor am I personally completely isolated. We do have regular meetings of Northwest Front comrades and other people who really do live here, right in the Northwest homeland. In fact, we had such a meeting a couple of weeks ago down in Salem, Oregon. And I also had the pleasure of taking Thanksgiving dinner with some of our people here in Washington. Since the NF got officially started, I've traveled to Oregon and to Idaho to meet with our people there, and at some point around the spring, I hope to make it as far as Montana. In addition, a lot of people have come here to meet me, both in Astoria and here in Starbucks City. However, I have to be honest, I'm not just one lone guy sitting in a trailer with nothing but a computer, like the goat-dancing shitheads say, no. But on the other hand, I will be the first to admit you couldn't really say that the NF is much of an organization or a movement as yet, by any stretch of the imagination, even if we were doing things the old way, which we're not. Now, to say that it is very, very hard to get so-called white nationalists to take any physical action of any kind out here in the real world would be to wildly understate the problem. Half the time, people who promise to come to our meetings just don't show up. They flake, and sometimes they send excuses, sometimes they just get the jim-jams and they disappear. Now, that kind of thing happens all the time. I or one of our other people will show up at a meeting in a public place to do the first one-on-one with some internet contact, and half the time the guy never shows. And those who do show come expecting to find some big organization with a crowd that they can hide in. And when they find out that they themselves are expected to step forward and provide the first man in the crowd, wherein others will eventually hide, then all of a sudden their enthusiasm distinctly wanes and they never show up for a second meeting. Another problem we have is that unlike any right-wing or racial group I have ever heard of in the past, the Northwest Front actually does background checks on people. And frankly, we weed out some people even before the first meeting. And the word seems to have gotten around that we are checking people out, and that tends to make a lot of our internet contacts skittish, shall we say. But then again, that's probably all to the good. So if you're spying on us for the FBI or the ADL or whoever, you can tell your bosses that they don't have anything to worry about yet. I still haven't found the magic words or the magic beans or whatever to make people start responding in the real world in any numbers. And in that sense, yeah, I won't deny that the goat dancing fools have something of a point. But the fact is that in the Northwest Front, we're at least trying to bring this thing of ours off the internet and back into the real world. And nobody else I know of is even trying. Slowly, slowly, hideously, achingly slowly, the mountain is starting to move. We have several primary settlement areas we're trying to bring people into here in the homeland, and once again, with the speed of a moving glacier, the word is starting to get out in the movement that there are indeed a few places in the Pacific Northwest where someone can go and find actual people, not email addresses and comic book guy from The Simpsons hiding in his basement behind his computer, but real, live, normal people. And folks are starting to pay attention. At some point in time, we're going to hit a kind of a tipping point, and the word really will get out, and all of a sudden, we're finally going to see those out-of-state license plates coming over the hill. The Northwest message is starting to get out, and people are starting to think in terms of blue, white, and green. It's happening, Tracy. Dead slow, but it's happening. The growth in interest is very noticeable. Okay, yeah, granted, mostly it's internet interest. And when the time comes to use real vacation days off work that could be used in play, and when the time comes to actually get behind the wheel of an automobile or get on a jet airliner in some cases and come here to see the homeland, then all of a sudden a lot of those email addresses go dark. It's 3 steps forward and 2 steps back, 3 steps forward and 2 steps back, and I've never denied that. Now, you look up the term long, hard road home in a dictionary, and you'll find see Northwest Migration. But no, Tracy, I'm not all alone here. There are real live people with me, more than there were last year, but not as many as there are going to be this time next year. That's progress. And so long as we're moving forward at all in some area that involves doing things other than sitting behind a computer, then we're the biggest game in town. Actually, we've been the biggest game in town for some time. It's just hard to grasp that through all the internet static and noise. Okay, we're going to take our first music break. I've been getting some irate emails from some of our listeners complaining that my music selections for the program lately have been way too pointy-headed and esoteric and bagpipey, and they want to hear some Ian Stewart or some other kind of white noise or oi-type rock cuts. I've had my attention directed, by the way, to a group called Man O' War, kind of racial heavy metal, and it was recommended that I play this one song, and when I checked Amazon.com, they had dozens of cuts by Man O' War, but of course not the one that I was looking for. So I'm still trying to fish that one up. Anyway, for all you skinheads of all ages out there, here's Ian Stewart and Screwdriver with After the Fire. Burn out.
life that would not die. After the fire, the ruins and delay. After the fire, will come a brand new day.
Quick return to the subject of Edgar Steele, if you don't mind. I did that section of the podcast last night, and for various reasons it became necessary for me this morning to change a few things on it. So I recorded some patches on my USB mic here, and I went into the main file, I edited it with WavePad, and I dropped those patches in. I don't know if you guys could tell I'd been editing the track there, maybe so, because I'm not super good at it. Or maybe not, because you just weren't expecting it or listening for it. But the point I'm trying to make is that I did drop some words and phrases into this audio track. And if I can do it on my little home computer here, the FBI can damn sure alter the audio on their surveillance tapes. Now, we say tapes, but in actual fact, what they're most likely going to be using against Edgar Steele in court will not be physical magnetic recording tapes like back in the old days, which would have to be carefully spliced and then re-recorded onto a clean tape, but digital audio tracks like this podcast, and those are very easily edited and altered indeed. I know, because I've just done it myself right here on this program. But once again, guys, and I cannot emphasize this enough, never trust anything that anyone in law enforcement or the legal or judicial system says, and that includes anything they come up with by way of alleged evidence that someone has committed a crime. We're dealing with people who are fundamentally dishonest and with an entire system which is based on deception and political and financial considerations and not on any principles of justice or fairness. Next up is another commentary from Gretchen the Librarian in New England. It seems Gretchen actually is accumulating a few fans on this show. Now, I get asked periodically why I don't pretend that I'm an actual radio host and do a call-in show or a talk show like I was Rush Limbaugh or some kind of Glenn Beck wannabe. There are several reasons for that, and some of them have to do with technology, like I'd have to fool around with Skype again, and that damn thing has already crashed my computer once with the 100 or so bloody viruses that it let into my system. But mostly, and I freely admit this, it's because I intend to maintain control over everything that goes out into the public domain under my name, be it written or audio. I'm sure that by now most of you guys have picked up on the fact that we got a lot of people in the movement who, people who basically just want to play in various senses of the term. Well, that is, of course, their right. It's their computer and their time. And if they want to use this incredible new medium of communication and persuasion to play, there's nothing I can do about it. They're just not going to do it here. This site and this show and this part of the movement are not about playtime for silly white boys or for silly middle-aged white men who seem to have discovered a fountain of childishness. The Northwest Imperative is adults only. Now, that having been said, I really would like to get some more MP3 files from you folks out there in our listening audience. I've already referred to this smear that they've been putting out claiming that there is no one else involved in the Northwest Front but me. Well, that's pretty standard. They've been doing that for the past 20 years. That's pretty easy to refute. since anyone who gets involved with the NF, even peripherally, can tell you different. And the word's already out that, yes, we actually have real people. But it would be easier still if I could get some voices besides my own on this show, preferably every week. So once again, guys, pick up that mic, take some time, make a 5 or 6 minute audio, MP3 file, or .wma, or make it longer than 5 or 6 minutes if you want. And so long as you're compos mentis and you got something to say, and you're not trying to use the show as a form of playtime, I'll certainly let you have your say on Radio Free Northwest here. Here's Gretchen.
Good evening, comrades. Lately, I've had the opportunity to have a lot of what might be called food for thought in two ways, both through my own experiences lately and also in the fact that Harold recently sent me an edition of the Occidental Quarterly. And because of that, I've been thinking about the various philosophies that people have. And of course, we know basically there's really three out there. One is people who really still believe in maybe trying to become influential in society, and they think that there's really nothing wrong with the system, but that they can somehow bring back the 1950s. Surprisingly, that is a school of thought, and it is out there. It honestly is very surprising to me because I really don't understand how anyone thinks that this could actually work given the way the world is today. Then, of course, you have your PLE school of thought, and these are people who may think about going to some community somewhere, perhaps a farm, maybe living like the Mennonites or the Amish. I know that this is something that Harold is very much against. I think that people such as the Amish and the Mennonites, at this point, I mean, those groups, they seem fairly safe. And, you know, maybe, I mean, I know what happened with the Weavers. I know what happened with the Montana Freemen. Certainly, I'm old enough to remember those things. But no one's bothering the Amish, so, all right, it's not a very Promethean dream, but I suppose there are people who have that dream, and it's slightly more viable than bringing back the 50s. I don't know if that's viable into the distant future when there's going to be more and more non-whites. I don't know if that lifestyle could maintain itself or not. And then, of course, you have the third option, which is nation building. Now, this option is the one that really excites me the most. And I ask myself, why? Am I just an incorrigible scrapper? Is there something kind of crazy about me that makes me interested in this? Well, the reality is that nation building gives us opportunities that you would never have in the other two scenarios. You can have a sustainable population that's large enough. You can have a coastline. You can have desalination plants. You can have a military. You can have an air force. You can have a national service. You can have a constitution that is a system that doesn't have the pathways for invading organisms, let's just say. The system that we have, really, it was designed in the 18th century, and it just didn't take into account an age of mass migration, an age of globalism, an age of race chaos, really, that we have. It just didn't take those things into account because it was made in a very different time. I'm not saying it was a bad thing or, you know, people are sentimental about the founding fathers and the American Revolution and so forth, and that's fine. It's nothing bad about it. It's simply there were things that it just didn't take into account. It wasn't as racial a system as what we'll be able to build. So I'm in the nation-building camp. Harold sent me an Occidental Quarterly, and in it, there's a lot of food for thought. It talks about how people can be very inspired by nation-building in a way that they're not going to be inspired by a farm. It has some very interesting articles in it. There's an article that deals with multiculturalism, and it actually advocates supporting a lot of causes that might be thought of as liberal. such as even things like abortion, if you can stomach doing that, and things like bilingualism and things like Astaland, because it makes white secession a more thinkable view, because the more things become balkanized, the more thinkable white secession would be. And I actually think there's merit in this view, so that was quite interesting. It also talks about perhaps cooperation with other groups, if that would be possible. I don't know to what extent that would be possible. I really have to say I'm enjoying this edition. I think everyone should read this and really consider everything that it's saying in terms of strategies, because I really think that this pathway is the one that offers us the most opportunities. I really have to say I'm mystified at anybody at this point who would not be thinking along these lines. So the message is really about changing the entire way that you think about the world, changing the stories that you tell yourself. Right now, the popular story is how great multiracialism is. The story is affecting really everyone's morale. It takes a very strong will to resist it, and it's just very hard for anybody to resist it, but it essentially says that what you have to do is you have to change the way you think it, you have to change the way you view the world, and that's really the first step to other things, is to change your thinking. And it starts out by analyzing the phrase white nationalism, which started to be used in the 90s. Some people don't really mean it because they're still basically conservatives, but some people do mean it. And if you do mean it, what does that mean? Just revamping your entire way of looking at things. I think sometimes people think that white nationalism is conservatism, or they come through conservatism and they favor conservative causes, but this journal reminds us it's really not conservatism at all, but it's really a whole new agenda and how you can reconfigure and re-strategize for that new agenda. So I really thank Harold for sending this to me, because I'm really very interested in thought systems and how they figure into new strategies that we need. So thank you for sending this to me, and I hope you've enjoyed my commentary.
Well, glad you liked it, Gretchen. I think I got some more Occidental Quarterlies than some theoretical journals of that kind lying around, actually, and so I'll see if I can drop them in the mail to you. Right, second music break. I think we'll go for a little Riverdance music, although it's certainly not as much fun without the video of the dancers, especially the girls. One girl in particular I always look for whenever I see any of the original Dublin cast performances. Anyway, this is from the original Lord of the Dance album, conducted by Ronan Hardiman. I now want to address yet again one of the many objections that people raise against the Northwest migration. And yes, this one is apparently dead serious, because it keeps popping its head up in various forms. Now, I didn't get this from an email. I got it from a post on a Facebook group that I belong to. The objection is that we mustn't migrate to the Northwest or try to establish a homeland in the Northwest because we might get wiped out. Not by a Zog nuclear attack or by a Chinese invasion, although I've heard those as well. No, we must not attempt to establish a homeland in the Pacific Northwest because we might be destroyed by volcanoes. I really don't know what to say about this one. Yes, I know we have volcanoes in the Northwest, notably Mount St. Helens, of course, which blew her top in 1980, and it was a big mess to clean up, although we survived it quite handily with only a small number of casualties, including one old guy named Harry Truman who was just too plain stubborn to come down off the mountain when he was warned. I've seen pictures of the streets in Centralia, where I used to live, and they're covered in ash, looks like a big snowstorm, and it was a long and expensive cleanup job. But the people here did, in fact, survive, just as we will survive any future eruptions, just like Rome itself survived the eruption that buried Pompeii. Like I said, I really don't know how to answer this one. It's true that Mount Rainier is a dormant volcano, and if memory serves, so are Mount Hood down in Oregon and Mount Baker up by the Canadian border. Yes, they may erupt someday, and that day may come after we've achieved white independence. But I'm sorry, I don't know where exactly I seem to have conveyed the idea that the Northwest American Republic will not have the same emergency services as the United States, and better, to cope with such a natural disaster. I think if we're capable of pulling off a revolution and getting the United States off our backs, then we'll be quite capable of putting together emergency contingency plans to deal with volcano eruptions and earthquakes. Yeah, we get earthquakes here too, you know, and tsunamis and forest fires or whatever. Not only that, but we'll be able to do it better than the United States. See, our white republic isn't going to be Haiti, and it isn't going to be New Orleans full of hapless black idiots who sit around when some natural catastrophe occurs just waiting in the ruins for the white man to come and bail them out. Now, guys, we can always think up a dozen excuses to continue to sit where we are and tap on our computers and do nothing. Now, the volcano excuse is just one of the more exotic ones. I think anyone who genuinely refuses to come to the Northwest homeland because he's afraid of volcanoes probably isn't going to make the kind of citizen we need anyway. And as someone once said, the white gene pool needs a heavy dose of chlorine.
No time to count what I'm worth, 'cause I just left the planet Earth. Where I go, I'll hope there's rum.
One last comment before we move on. I would like to thank the gentleman who posted that on Facebook, though, for one thing. He posted his comments under his own name and without attempting to hide behind a false identity. At least when this gentleman says what he has to say, we know who's saying it. Right, on to the email box. This is from Brent in Oregon. I should have got on this last week, but I promised him I'd get to it this week. Hello, HAC. My mind was wandering on the future of the Northwest Republic, and a question crossed my mind as to how the NAR would handle our science. We can't foresee what bad blood will be created through the founding of this new nation, and we should responsibly assume that we can only rely on ourselves for some, most, or all of the foreseeable future. We should have some legitimate concerns for seasonal ills and any serious contagion that may make its way into our communities. I'm sure that to a degree we could receive some aid from somewhere, but for a nation who will, to a degree, pride itself on its separation from its neighbors, I think something like this is one that we should take into consideration. Just thinking. First off, Brent, I can tell you right now that in a scenario such as you describe, the same liberal states who have just poured untold billions of dollars into the open-air latrine which is Haiti, billions of dollars which seem to have disappeared without a trace, and which have produced no discernible improvements in the condition of the wretched niggers who live in Haiti at all, to the point where almost a year after the earthquake, they're still living in rubble and dealing with a cholera epidemic. Anyway, those liberal governments and the United Nations will be quite happy to stand by and see every white child in the Northwest American Republic die of disease or famine or whatever they can inflict through economic sanctions and maybe biological warfare as well. Remember what this wonderful, compassionate, liberal state of ours did to the children of Iraq for all those years before 2003? You're right, Brent. Once we set up on our own, we will be truly on our own. Every nation on earth will be against us, with the possible exception of Russia and certain Muslim states. And don't get me into that, because that's a whole nother subject. This is one reason I decided to go ahead and write the Fifth Northwest novel, to discuss the problems that the newborn republic will face and make some suggestions as to how to deal with these problems, not the least among them public health. The Northwest American Republic will have to rely on science and technology to make up for the loss of population and resources and money which will arise from the separation from the United States and with the whole world. My own belief is that we need to set up a number of scientific research facilities in conjunction with the state, the military, and the universities, and basically just throw them open to every scientist, engineer, eccentric PhD, mad scientist, and just plain crackpot in the Western world, and pretty much back all their projects and ideas and theories, the ones that they haven't been able to get anyone interested in the West because they don't serve the profit motive or because they're politically incorrect or whatever. Levitation, plasma rays, laser weapons, cancer cures, medical stuff of all kinds, huge genetically engineered vegetables like in that Woody Allen movie, Sleeper, cloning dinosaurs like Jurassic Park, you name it. We especially pursue any kind of theory or technology to do with alternative, non-petroleum fuel and energy sources, including engines that run on methane or alcohol, solar power, fusion nuclear reactors, kryptonite, anything. We take these ideas and theories and projects and experiments as far as they'll go, until it's conclusively proven one way or the other that they either work or they don't. Mostly don't, I would imagine. But even if 9 out of 10 of these crackpot research projects turn out to be moonshine, that 10th project that works will produce something that we need, something that'll keep us independent of the rest of the world, something that'll feed our people or heal our people or send us into outer space, whatever. The Northwest Republic must become the world's leader in innovative technology because our lives will literally depend on it. Third music break. This is from Eleanor in Boca Raton. Dear HAC, I just finished reading your Northwest novel, A Mighty Fortress, and I believe that the next to last chapter, wherein you describe the raising of the tricolor flag over the peace conference at Longview, to be one of the most moving scenes in all of literature. Oh, shucks, ma'am. Anyway, where was I? I've also listened to almost all of your Radio Free Northwest podcasts, and it seems to me that in your music selections you've not yet played Martin Luther's hymn Ein fester Berg ist unser Gott, the national anthem of the Northwest Republic. Why not? Oh, good point, Eleanor. I dug around for a German version, which is what was played in the book, but the ones I found weren't really suitable for one reason or another. They were too long, there was too much organ, whatever. I did find this one fairly passable English version. I know you guys will complain that this sounds too much like a hymn to be a national anthem. Well, that's because it is a hymn. Try to imagine this done up with a brass band or an orchestra or Moog synthesizer or whatever you need to make it sound like a proper national anthem. Imagine this being played every night when the television stations sign off. And yes, in the Northwest Republic, they'll sign off until 6 or 7 in the morning. We don't need TV at 3 a.m. I think that's one of the crucial places in the past where society got into trouble. Anyway, we won't get into that. This is the St. Olaf Choir. Okay, another email, and I'm sorry to say that I seem to have lost track of who sent this in, for which I apologize. Anyway, it reads, Dear HAC, I've thought that, as you probably already pondered, Northwest Front might benefit from having a mother to your father, a more placid and kinder face to complement your stern warnings and admonishments. My thought was perhaps that this could all be accomplished and put a more welcoming tone to your efforts by posting a success story every month, giving a kind of a telegenic face on YouTube to some different mother every month that was struggling under Zog and received help from the Northwest Front, perhaps some blankets, toys, or just time helping around the house. Their stories could dispel what people view as inherently negative, show your cause to be the quest of caring that it really is, and give a face to the progress. I know it's an idea in the rough, and perhaps you've already considered such and dismissed it. Just sharing a thought. Thanks again. I look forward to your next show. And again, I apologize for losing this person's name when I transfer the email here, and whoever you are, anyway, thanks for sending that in. Okay. So, as I understand it, your idea is that we help out a deserving somebody every month, such as a white single mother in some way, which I certainly approve of, and we then negate all the good we've done to this person by posting his or her story and picture on YouTube, thus targeting her for every piece of left-wing or black or Jewish pond scum on the internet, the news media, and quite possibly job loss and harassment by the police and the FBI. What's wrong with this picture? Ah, comes the dawn. Nonetheless, I get your point, and actually, you're moseying in the general direction of the right track. Now, how do you think organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah, the Taliban and the IRA maintain their hold over their own people? It's not just by the AK-47 alone. They provide social welfare services, medical services, employment, and keep order in their own communities, things that the Zionist and capitalist occupiers cannot or will not provide. As to my stern admonitions, yeah, I get that too. I've talked about this before, but fine, we'll go over it again. I use the stick so much because I don't have a carrot to offer. The primary obstacle that affects and directs every move we make is that the NF has no money. These other groups I just mentioned do. They have subsidies from Iran and Saudi Arabia, subsidies from the Afghan poppy fields. In the IRA's case, they have most of the various rackets in Belfast and Derry, and they got a cut from a lot of the rackets in Glasgow and London, so forth and so on. Now, before some dummox hears that and gets the wrong idea, please, nobody go running out and rob any banks or armored cars and come here and dump the money out of paper bags onto my desk, would you? My name isn't William Pierce, and I don't have his immunity or whatever his arrangement was. If I get caught doing that shit, I'll go to prison for the rest of my life. Not that we need rackets or armored car robberies. Our website is now up to 4,000 hits per week, and I assume that most of those are Radio Free Northwest listeners. All I'd need would be $10 a month voluntary dues from all those people. Now, that's almost $500,000 a year. And we'd be able to pay our own people to do the right thing. That's what Americans have been socially engineered all their lives to respond to. Show an American a paycheck and he'll jump up and bark and roll a ball on his nose like a trained seal. If the Northwest Front could pay even minimum wage salary and provide a mattress on the floor and a can of beans once a day, I could have 50 guys up here before New Year's. Now, right now we can't, but one day we'll be able to buy from our own people what should be offered voluntarily and joyfully. I no longer care anymore, so long as somehow it gets done. In a perfect world, we wouldn't have to pay our people to do right. But it's not a perfect world. I'm finally coming to accept that our people are what they are, and there's virtually nothing that can be done to change them. Guys, let's stay focused on the exact goal we're now trying to achieve, which is very simple and completely doable. Now, I'm a throwback to an earlier breed, an earlier genetic prototype among our kind, if you will. But I'm not the only one, although we are getting more and more rare. But we don't need many, just 1,000. That's all I'm trying to do right now. I'm trying to locate, identify, contact, and motivate 1,000 white men and women who still have the same gene or chromosome or character trait or whatever it is that I have. The ones who don't have to be bought with goods and services. The true pioneers, the ones who are willing to go first. And I mean really do it. Actually come here, or if they're already here in the homeland, who are willing to make a lifetime commitment to a free and sovereign nation for white people here in the Northwest. I'm looking for the first 1,000 Northwest volunteers. Now, this one I'm doing now is all aimed at that goal. I need to get those people here, get them properly placed, get them organized into small activity groups or cells or teams or crews or whatever you want to call them. This is the overture. Once it's done, we'll begin the main show. It's a tall order, but it's not in any way impossible or beyond the bounds of reality or beyond the capabilities that we have right now. I'm simply asking 1,000 people to do for their race what hundreds of thousands of Americans do every year because they're paid. Somewhere out there are 1,000 white men and women who will do just that. We simply have to find them. For all I know, I may be speaking to one of you now. Am I? Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. Now, this is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.